your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365. Bam! 365, where you find every day Black history is made.
Our way of saying it's Wednesday, 8 p.m., and time for So What's Your Story? I'm Warren Holloman. Tonight I'll be your host. Joining me to help with the show are Nicole Rocher-Lynn and Hank Rubicek. I trust both of you had enjoyable Easter and Passover holidays?
I did for the most part. How about you, Dr. Hank?
Well, I had a very nice holiday. You know, Passover is pretty much up there on the food chain. All the holidays in Judaism is pretty much the same. It's, you know, they try to kill us, they couldn't, let's eat. But this one was a really very significant one. And if there's anybody out there who thinks like Sean Spicer, it's about slavery. And it's a really critical holiday. And it was a beautiful one. I kind of miss it growing up, having seders and everything, but it was very nice. Thank you for asking.
Yeah, well, I think when we experience ignorance in our culture, we know why it's important that we remember these things, and it's important that we continue these traditions. Nicole, Hank, and I are privileged to be part of the coolest team on the radio, along with Mary Edgerton, Greg Aldell, Alondra Mejia, and Lisa Moore. We're proud to be the only program in Houston, originating in Houston, devoted entirely to storytelling. And we're right here on listener-sponsored 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. The reason we all do this show is because we believe that every day of every life is a story worth telling, and we believe that every good story has power. Power to bring meaning to our lives, power to bind us together as families, as friends, and as a community. Now, there are all kinds of stories. You got your personal stories, like the type we tell at the Moth. There are family stories. There are religious stories, and then there's another type of story that we call folk tales, or sometimes fairy tales, and that's what tonight's show is all about. With that, I'm going to welcome tonight's guest storyteller, who actually is not a guest at all, because she's also one of our co-hosts, but she is a storyteller. She tells stories at the Moth, and she's told stories on our show. Mary Edgerton, welcome, sort of, to So What's Your Story?
Hey, Warren, it's so great to be here. And you know, the last time that I was your guest was actually my first time on the show, before I became a co-host.
I remember that very well. We had a lot of fun, and I think we will tonight.
Oh, I've been very excited about this. I'm really looking forward to it.
And then, speaking of previous shows, I've got to say how much I enjoyed the show last week. You were the host, of course, and your guest was Dr. Bob Dempsey, a flight director from NASA. He told some absolutely riveting stories about the space program.
You know, that was so exciting, and to realize that every time a flight director is on duty, they are responsible for people's lives. And interestingly, NASA is just coming out with a new documentary about the flight directors through the Apollo program.
Cool. Cool. And I know he said he and his other flight directors have written a book as well.
Yes.
I can't wait for that.
It's good for them to get attention.
Yeah. So last week's show was about the future, so to speak. The outer space exploration, stuff that I never thought would happen in my lifetime. Tonight's show, we're going in the opposite direction. We're going back a few thousand years. Could you tell us about tonight's show, what you've got planned for us?
Tonight we're going to have folk tales, fairy tales, as you mentioned, old and new. So some of ours date back, I think, 4,000 years. I'd like to, well, we have a couple of them. But fairy tales, folk tales are really expressing a part of life. And so I have a couple of updated versions, maybe set in the past, but can bring you to the future in different ways. Or the present.
So cool. So what are the two traditional stories that you're going to then retell for the modern age?
Well, we have one from the West and one from the East. And so from the West, we have the traditional Rumpelstiltskin.
Oh, yeah. So sweet.
Scary. One of my least favorites, and interestingly, in learning about it, it dates back about 4,000 years.
Wow.
And it is supposed to be reminiscent of some retelling of human wars against Neanderthals and the folly of trade with others.
Wow.
I don't know who's the Neanderthal in Rumpelstiltskin. But the one from the East is The Boy Who Drew Cats. And that's an unfamiliar tale, and I'm going to enjoy hearing it and giving you the updated version.
Yeah. And that's Japanese, as I understand
it. That one is Japanese.
Yeah, so we're going to play the traditional Rumpelstiltskin, then you're going to give a modern version. Then in the second half of the show, I think I'll read The Boy Who Drew Cats, and then you've got...
I've got a one that I actually wrote that's based on The Boy Who Drew Cats, and I'll tell you a little bit more about it when we get there.
And so we're starting with Rumpelstiltskin. Who's reading this?
Well, this is going to be Danny Kaye.
Yeah.
And it dawns on some of us that some of us may not know who Danny Kaye was. Danny Kaye was an entertainer in the 1950s and 60s when there were these entertainers that I think were, you could consider the transition from vaudeville to television today. One of the really interesting things about Danny Kaye, who was a singer and read stories and he was an actor and he was in movies, he was the original Walter Mitty in the 1947 movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's another one that's been updated.
He was omnipresent when I was young. He was on TV. Sort of the vaudeville comes to TV kind of performance.
He was. Yeah. He was.
Well, let's roll it, Nicole. Danny Kaye telling Rumpelstiltskin.
Once in a faraway land, there was a very, very poor man who had a very beautiful daughter. Now, it happened one day that he met the king, and he wanted to make himself seem rather important. "I," he said grandly, "have a daughter who can spin straw into gold." "How interesting," said the king. "Bring her to my palace, and I will put her to the test." When the girl was brought to him, he took her into a room full of straw, gave her a spinning wheel, and said, "If by tomorrow morning you have not spun this straw into gold, you must die." Then he locked the door and left her in the room, all alone. "Oh, dear," cried the girl, "whatever shall I do?" Because, of course, she had no idea at all how to spin straw into gold. But suddenly, the door opened, and in stepped a little man.
"Good evening, girl," he said. "Why are you crying so?"
"Alas, I have to spin this straw into gold, and I don't know how to do it."
"What will you give me if I do it for you?" asked the little man.
"I am very poor," she wept, "and I have nothing of value to give you."
"Well then," said the little man, "will you promise to give me your first child if you should become queen?"
"Queen?" thought the girl. "Me? I'll never become queen."
So she promised. And the little man sat himself in front of the wheel with a handful of straw. The straw became gold. He worked until daybreak, and by then all the straw was spun, and the room was full of gold. Early in the morning, the king came, and when he saw the gold, he could hardly believe his eyes. "This is only a poor man's daughter," he thought, "but where can I find a richer bride?" And he said to the girl, "You shall be my queen." So they were married. And a year later, they had a beautiful child. When the young queen's baby was exactly 1 week old, the strange little man suddenly appeared in her room.
"Now," he said, "you must give me what you promised."
"Oh, no," anything else, cried the queen. Take all my riches, but leave me my child. And she wept and moaned and begged, and finally he said,
very well, I will give you 3 days. If in that time you can find out my name, you may keep your baby.
During the night, the queen lay awake, trying to remember all the names she had ever heard. And when the little man came the next day, she began.
Jonathan? Joseph? Jeremiah? Timothy? Titus? Obadiah? William Henry Walter Sim? Reuben? Rufus Solomon? Jim? Nathaniel? Daniel, Abraham, Roderick, Frederick, Peter, Sam, Casper, Jasper, Nicholas, Pat, Christopher, Jack, Jehoshaphat.
No, 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 no. At last she had said all the names she knew, and the little man laughed and went away. That night, the queen sent a messenger out to discover every unusual name that anyone in the countryside knew of. And the next day, she had another long list.
Xavier, Xerxes, Zittleby, Zorch.
But the little man said, no, 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 no.
And again, he went away. And again, the queen sent her messenger out. But when he came back on the last morning, he said, not another name have I been able to find, Your Majesty.
Oh, no, she wept, no.
But I did see something strange, said the messenger. Far out at the edge of the forest I saw a little house, and in front of it a bonfire was burning, and in front of the fire a strange little man hopping on one foot and singing,
today I brew, tomorrow I bake, and then the young queen's child I'll take. Oh, ho, she'll lose the guessing game, for Rumpelstiltskin is my name.
Oh, thank you, cried the queen.
Soon afterwards, the little man appeared.
Now, Your Majesty, he thundered. What is my name?
The queen smiled.
Perhaps, Tom?
No.
Maybe Dick?
No.
Well then, said Her Majesty, there's nothing left but
Rumpelstiltskin.
You guessed it, shrieked the little man. I won't have it. I won't stand for it. And he stamped his right foot into the ground so hard that he sank up to his waist. Then he stamped his left leg so hard that he disappeared completely.
And Rumpelstiltskin was never seen again.
If you're just joining us, this is So What's Your Story on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. Down in Galveston, you can catch us at 89.5, and in Huntsville, 91.9. And if you're anywhere in the world or even in outer space, our astronauts listen to us online at www.kpft.org. I'm Warren Holloman. My guest tonight is, well, of course, that was Danny Kaye, and here in the flesh is Mary Edgerton. So, Mary, what do you think about that story? What stands out to you?
You know, what was really horrible to me every time I read the story, and it was horrible. I mean, the man that she ends up marrying had threatened to kill her several times, and then this little man saves her life but wants her oldest child, and then at the very end, he just rips himself in two. Is that not horrible?
Well, I think how easy we have it these days. We go to for counseling for things that are relatively minor compared to that.
I think that's traumatic.
Yeah. Is there a point to this story, a moral, a main point?
Well, you know, what I found online is what I mentioned before, is that this has something to do with wary of the folly of trade and was related to humans interacting with Neanderthals. And and as I say, to me, the king is the Neanderthal in all of them.
Well, and I think we were joking earlier that sometimes we think it's graduate students looking for a dissertation topic, but I do believe that folk tales and stories are not univocal. They have a multiplicity of meanings, multiple meanings. And 5 different people can listen to a story and hear 5 different things. And that's what's so powerful about stories. We were talking earlier about a book that some professors at University of Houston have published. Hank, in fact, is one of the authors. And one of the chapters is on Rumpelstiltskin. It's a book called Lessons in Mythology. But one of the chapters on Rumpelstiltskin explores some of the theories about the folk tale, that it's speaking to some of the male concerns of the day that usually are not spoken of overtly. One reading, for example, is that this is a story that's a subliminal way of talking about what it's like being gay. You know, a man has a paternal instinct, a desire to have children, but he doesn't have a, quote, mating instinct. And in some ways, he's the opposite, unfortunately, of a lot of men who have the mating instinct
without the fathering instinct.
Yeah.
And so true.
And then another way to look at it, it could be a story about male impotence. A man wants a child but can't have one, can't father them. So, I mean, we can see all kinds of things in there.
Well, I think you're right. Yeah. Every person sees a new one. But, you know, I'd like to take the Rumpelstiltskin story along a different direction. And I'm going to read you an updated version.
I can't wait.
I just fell in love with this. So let's go back to that third night when the king has said, you have to turn the straw into gold or you die. And if you do it, you get to marry me. Mm-hmm. Rumpelstiltskin comes in. That's quite a pile, he said. I suppose you want me to spin it into gold. Well, the situation has changed just a bit, said the miller's daughter, who also had a name. It was Meredith. If you don't, I will die. If you do, I marry the king. Well, now that, thought Rumpelstiltskin, has possibilities. After all, getting to be the queen was a big step up for the miller's daughter. She would surely pay him anything. And there was only one thing in the world he really wanted, a little child to love and care for. Okay. Here's the deal, he said. I will spin the straw into gold, just like before. In return, once you become queen, you must let me adopt your firstborn child. I promise I'll be an excellent father. I know all the lullabies. I'll read to the child every day. I'll even coach Little League. You've got to be kidding, Meredith said. I'd rather marry you than that jerk. Really? Said Rumpelstiltskin. And he blushed all the way from the top of his head to the tip of his toes, which admittedly wasn't very far because he was so short. Sure, she said. I like your ideas on parenting. You'd make a good provider. And I have a weakness for short men. So Rumpelstiltskin spun a gold ladder and they escaped out the window. They were married the very next day and lived happily together far, far away from the palace. Meredith and Rumpelstiltskin lived a quiet country life, raising chickens and growing vegetables. Every now and then, when they needed something they couldn't make or grow, Rumpelstiltskin would spin up a little gold to buy it with. Now they had a daughter, and she was just as sunny and clever as you would expect her to be, having such devoted parents. When she was 16, they decided she ought to see more of the world. So every now and then, they allowed her to take the gold into town to exchange it for coins and to do a little shopping. The goldsmith grew curious about the pretty country girl who came in with those odd coils of gold. He mentioned it to his friend the baker, who mentioned it to the blacksmith, who mentioned it to the tax collector, who hurried to the palace and told the king. It may not surprise you to learn that the king hadn't changed a bit. If anything, he was greedier than before. As he listened, his eyes glittered. "I once knew a miller's daughter who could make gold like that," he said. "Unfortunately, she got away. Let's make sure this one doesn't." So the next time Rumpelstiltskin's daughter went to see the goldsmith, two of the king's guards were waiting for her. In a red-hot minute, she was in a carriage and speeding toward the palace. And what she saw on the way broke her heart. Everywhere the fields lay barren. Sickly children stood begging beside the road. Nobody in the kingdom had anything anymore because the king had it all. Finally, they reached the palace. There were high walls around it and a moat full of crocodiles. Armed guards were everywhere, gnashing their teeth, clutching their swords, and peering about with shifty eyes. As the carriage went over the bridge and under the portcullis, the hungry people shook their fists at them. It was not a pretty sight. Rumpelstiltskin's daughter was taken at once to the grand chamber where the king sat on his golden throne. He didn't waste time on idle pleasantries. "Where did you get this?" he asked, showing her the gold. Said Rumpelstiltskin's daughter. "I thought so," said the king. "Guards, take her to the tower and see what she can do with all that straw." Rumpelstiltskin's daughter looked around. She saw a pile of straw the size of a bus. She saw a locked door and high windows. She gave a big sigh and began to think. She knew her father could get her out of this pickle, but she had heard stories about the king all her life. One room full of gold would never satisfy him. Her father would be stuck here, spinning until there was not an iota of straw left in the kingdom. After a while, she climbed the pile of straw and thought some more. She thought about the poor farmers and about the hungry children with their thin faces and sad eyes. She put the two thoughts together and cooked up a plan. Then Rumpelstiltskin's daughter curled up and went to sleep. The next day, the king was very disappointed. "Where's my gold?" he wanted to know. "I'm sure you have rooms full of it upstairs," said Rumpelstiltskin's daughter. And she was right, he did. "But I want more," he said, "and I want you to make it for me." "Alas," she said, "I never made gold in my life. But," and here she paused for effect, "I saw my grandfather make it." When the king's face brightened, she added, "Oh, he died years ago." "Surely you remember how he did it," cried the king. "Think, think." "Well," she said slowly, "there is one thing I'm sure of. He didn't spin it, he grew it." The next morning, the king and Rumpelstiltskin's daughter got into his glittering coach with two guards up front and two guards behind and a huge bag of gold inside. They drove under the portcullis over the bridge and out into the countryside. At the first farm they came to, they stopped and sent for the farmer. He was thin and ragged and barefoot. So were his wife and children. "Now tell the farmer he must plant this gold coin in his field, and you will come back in the fall to collect everything it has grown. Tell him you will give him another gold coin for his pains," she whispered. "Oh, do I have to?" whined the king. "Well, I don't know," she said. "That's how my grandfather always did it." "Okay," said the king, "but this better work." He gave the farmer two gold coins, and they hurried on to the next farm. By the end of the week, they had covered the entire kingdom. All through the summer, the king was restless. "Is it time yet? Is the gold ripe?" "Wait," said Rumpelstiltskin's daughter. And finally August came and went. "Now," she said, "now you can go and see what has grown in the fields." So once again they piled into the glittering coach. And as they neared the first farm, the king gasped with joy. The field shone golden in the morning sun. "Gold," he said. "No," said Rumpelstiltskin's daughter, "something better than gold." "How can anything be better than gold?" said the king. "It's wheat," she said. "You can eat it. You can't eat gold." Before the king could start turning purple, the farmer and his family came running towards a carriage. In their arms, they carried baskets of wheat and barley and apples and green beans and pumpkins and corn and I don't know what all. They piled it into the wagon and kissed the king's hand, grinning ear to ear. "I can promise you that nothing like that had ever happened to the king before." "Well," he said sheepishly, "maybe there will be gold at the next place." But everywhere it was the same. The land prospered, the children looked healthy, and the king was a hero. At the end of the week, they returned to the palace with all the food the wagons could carry. The cook was so overjoyed, he put on a sumptuous feast to celebrate. After dinner, the king spoke. "Well, that was all very nice, my dear," he said. "But you must have been mistaken. That was how your grandfather grew food, not how he made gold." "Right," she said, as she pulled her shawl tightly around her shoulders and gazed longingly at the fire. Even in the palace she could feel the chill of autumn. "Time for phase two," she thought. "Of course you're right," she said. "I told you it was long ago. But I think I remember now. He didn't grow gold. He knitted it with golden knitting needles." So the next day they loaded the coach with knitting needles, a bag of gold, and lots of yellow wool. And then they headed off, over the portcullis, under the bridge, and out into the countryside. At the first cottage they came to, they asked to see the granny. She hobbled to the door in her rags and curtsied to the king. "Now," whispered Rumpelstiltskin's daughter, "give her a bag of wool and a pair of needles. Tell her to knit it all up, and you will come back in a month to collect your riches. And give her a gold coin for your pains." Well, you can imagine that at the end of the month, when the king ordered his coach and wagons and rounded up his guards and went to see the grannies, what did he see? He thought he saw gold. And yes, it was gold. "Gold," cried the king. "Something better than gold," said Rumpelstiltskin's daughter. "Your people will be warm all winter." They were clothed in things knitted from the gold wool. Everyone brought presents for the king. By the time he got back to his palace, he had 17 sweaters, 42 mufflers, 8 vests, 1 pair of knickers, 135 pairs of socks, 12 nightcaps, and a tam-o'-shanter, all the color of gold. "Oh, do they suit me?" asked the king as he tried them on. "Absolutely," said Rumpelstiltskin's daughter. "Are you sure you don't remember how your grandfather made gold?" asked the king one day. "I'm afraid not," she said. "Oh, it's a terrible pity," he sighed. "But you did try, and as a reward, I have decided to make you my queen." "Oh, why don't you make me prime minister instead?" suggested Rumpelstiltskin's daughter. And so the king did just that, and he built her a nice house near the palace, and once a month she took off time to visit her parents. Oh, and I forgot to tell you, Rumpelstiltskin's daughter had a name, too. It was Hope.
Oh, that's incredible. I love it. How did you find this story?
You know, my daughter was going to this really interesting school. We were in Nashville, and the teacher told us one time that they were updating the fairy tales in class, and maybe Cinderella didn't go off with the prince. And about the same time, a review of this came out in the New York Times Book Review, and I said, I have to have this book.
So, and for our listeners, then...
It is Rumpelstiltskin's Daughter by Diane Stanley. It's a wonderful book. I got it off Amazon. My friends loved it so much at work that I had to go order a bunch more copies and give to them.
And I have to say, I'm sitting beside you looking at the illustrations, which are worth the price of the book by themselves. The drawings reflect sort of the worst opulence, I think, of France before the Revolution. Just really overdone.
Yes,
stuff.
Yes.
For the king, I mean.
And we won't mention who has his house done in Louis XIV gold right now.
Louis XIV, yeah, that's it. Yeah, so that's a rather subversive story.
It is. And, you know, not only does she outsmart the king, she has all the people being fed. She shows him how important it is to be loved. And at the very end, she doesn't want to be queen. She wants to be prime minister. I just love every part of this.
I do, too. Do you know of any other folk tales that have been updated like that?
Well, Into the Woods is an update of many folk tales. And I have to tell you, just last weekend, I saw Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs at the Catastrophic Theater.
Yeah.
And that is quite updated. Snow White is pretty bored with those dwarves.
Yeah.
And that prince doesn't come along and pull through. Oh, it's quite a take on Snow White.
Yeah. Great. Well, thanks so much. Now, I know we're going to come back and tell a couple of more stories in a little while. But first, I'd like to bring Nicole back into the conversation. Nicole Rumpelstiltskin, did you grow up having nightmares because of that story?
No, I did not. Although I have heard the story Rumpelstiltskin. My favorite was Pippi Longstocking. Yes, I loved it. I loved it. I'm so ashamed to say this. Well, actually, I'm not. I'm going to say it. I still sing the song, Pippi Longstocking is coming. You know, everybody want to sing with me. That was my girl. I loved it. I loved her.
And wonderful. I read the book in the third grade. I bought the book. Maybe it was the first book I bought for myself, but I loved it. But I didn't know there was a song.
Yes, yeah. Of course.
Well, if you're enjoying the show and you want to learn more about folk tales, Nicole and Mary and I would like to recommend that you check out the Houston Storytellers Guild.
That is right, Warren. Now, you know, the Houston Storytellers Guild is a great place to hear stories, swap stories, practice storytelling, and much, much more. You can also meet other people who enjoy doing the very same thing. And they meet the fourth Tuesday of every month at 1500 Sunset Boulevard. And you want to go there. You want to be there. You also can check out our past, So What's Your Story shows, on their website, www.HoustonStoryTellersGuild.org. Go to radio shows and make sure you check it out.
Yep. We love this Houston Storytellers Guild for all the reasons you've listed and one more. They sponsor our show, so we appreciate that. How about maybe this would be a good time to put in a plug for some of our social media activities?
Absolutely. Now, if you are not on our social media, you need to get in the know. Get into the story.
I'm trying.
Are on Facebook, guys. We are on Instagram. We do have our own YouTube channel, so you want to check it out. Make sure you do so, and make sure you like us on the way out. And tell a friend, by the way. Also, guys, next week, Greg Audell will be back. However, his story is a mystery, so you have to make sure you follow us on our social media outlets. We will be dropping some hints. We're dropping some hints. So if you want to know, make sure you're signed up so that you can find out. So with that being said, you do know you always can expect great things. Always on So What's Your Story, 90.1 KPFT Houston Pacifica Radio.
So last week we did stories about outer space. This week we're doing folk tales, and next week we're doing mysteries. That's a great genre. I love it.
Yes. Well,
thank you, Nicole. Well, shall we return to this week's show? Mary, I understand you have the second story is from Japan. It's about, well, why don't you introduce
it? Well, the second story is from Japan. It's The Boy Who Drew Cats. And when I was a little girl, my family gave me, for Christmas, because I was an avid reader, a book called Unfamiliar Marvels. And it had these very unfamiliar fairy tales, one of which was The Boy Who Drew Cats. And I loved that story. I read it over and over and over again.
How old were you?
I was about six, no, maybe 7 or 8. I was a precocious reader. I did read Ivanhoe in the second grade.
Oh, my gosh. So Nicole and I are a little bit humiliated there. We were struggling with Pippi Longstocking.
But I would love it, Warren, if you read The Boy Who Drew Cats to us.
I would love to. This is the version that Aaron Shepherd developed. There's many versions that we came across, but I like this one. Once there was a boy who loved to draw. His name was Joji. Joji grew up on a farm with lots of brothers and sisters. The others were a big help to their father and mother. But not Joji. He did nothing for hours but draw in the dirt with a stick. And what Joji drew was just one thing. Cats. Cats, cats, and more cats. Small cats, big cats, thin cats, fat cats, 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 cats. Joji, his father told him, you must stop drawing all those cats. How will you ever be a farmer? I'm sorry, father. I'll try to stop. And he did try. But whenever Joji saw one of the farm cats go by, he forgot his chores and drew another cat. Joji will never make a farmer, the farmer said sadly to his wife. Maybe he could be a priest, she told him. Why don't you take him to the temple? So the farmer brought Joji to the priest at the village temple. The priest said, I will gladly teach him. From then on, Joji lived at the temple. The priest gave him lessons in reading and writing. Joji had his own box. Sorry, I lost my place. Joji had his own box of writing tools with a brush and an ink stick and a stone. Joji loved to make the ink. He poured water in the hollow of the stone. He dipped the ink stick in the water. Then he rubbed the stick on the stone. and there was the ink for his brush. Now, the other students worked hard at their writing, but not Joji. With his brush and rice paper, he did nothing for hours but draw. And what Joji drew was just one thing. Cats. Cats, cats, and more cats. Small cats, big cats, thin cats, fat cats. Cats, 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 cats. Joji, the priest told him, you must stop drawing all those cats. How will you ever be a priest? I'm sorry, honorable sir. I'll try to stop. And he did try. But whenever Joji saw one of the temple cats go by, he forgot about his writing and drew another cat. That was bad enough. Then Joji started drawing on the folding screens of the temple. Soon there were cats on all the rice paper panels. They were everywhere. Joji, you'll never make a priest, the priest told him sadly. You'll just have to go home. Joji went to his room, and he packed his things. But he was afraid to go home. He knew his father would be angry. Then he remembered another temple in a village nearby. Maybe I can stay with the priest there. Joji started out walking. It was already night when he got to the other village. He climbed the steps to the temple and knocked, but there was no answer. He opened the heavy door. It was all dark inside. That's strange, said Joji. Why isn't anyone here? He lit the lamp by the door, then he saw something that made him clap. All around the big room were folding screens with empty rice paper panels. Joji got out his writing box and made some ink. Then he dipped in his brush and started to draw. And what Joji drew was just one thing. Cats, cats, and more cats. Small cats, big cats, thin cats, fat cats, 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 cats. The screen he drew on last was almost as long as the room. Joji covered it with one gigantic cat, the biggest and most beautiful cat he had ever drawn. Now Joji was tired, so he started to lie down, but something about that big room bothered him. I'll find someplace smaller. He found a cozy closet and settled inside. Then he slid shut the panel door and went to sleep. Late that night, Joji awoke in fright. It sounded like a large, fierce animal in the temple. Now he knew why no one was there. He wished he wasn't there either. He heard the thing sniff around the big room. It halted right in front of the closet. Then all at once, yow! There was a sound of struggling and a roar of surprise and pain. Then a huge thud that shook the floor. Then a soft padding sound. Then silence. Joji lay trembling in the dark. He stayed there for hours, afraid to look out of the closet. At last, daylight showed at the edge of the door. Joji carefully slid the door open, and he peered out. In the middle of the room lay a monster rat, a rat as big as a cow. It lay dead as if something had smashed it to the floor. Joji looked around the room. No one and nothing else was there, just the screen with the cats. Then Joji looked again at one gigantic cat. Didn't I draw the head to the left and the tail to the right? Yes, he was sure of it. But now the cat faced the other way, as if it had come down off the screen and then gone back up. The cat, said Joji. His eyes grew wide. Then he pressed his palm together and bowed to the screen. Thank you, honorable cat. You have saved me. For as long as I live, no one will stop me from drawing cats. When the villagers learned that the monster rat was dead, Joji became a hero. The village priest let him live in the temple as long as he liked, but Joji did not become a priest, and he did not become a farmer. He became an artist, a great artist, an artist honored through all the country, an artist who drew just one thing. Cats.
Now, isn't that a wonderful story? It really is one of my favorite stories.
And I had never heard of it. And I'm so glad you brought it to our attention.
I would never have known it if my family hadn't given me this book. And I looked into this story, and actually finding out what the origins were, I think, relates to why it was so appealing to me. This boy is the hero. Not because he's the prince, or he's handsome, or he's strong, or he's the hero because of his talent and because he's true to his passion.
Yeah.
And this is a Japanese part of their culture, that everybody is important and has a contribution. And it was just so refreshing. I was the little ugly girl who sat inside and read all the time. and it was just so refreshing that Joji was a little boy who made it because he just did what he did all the time, not what everybody else did.
Right. I mean, this story speaks to me as a 61-year-old man. There's an artist inside of me I've always felt that's wanted to get out, and I've never quite felt sort of permission. And this story kind of spoke to me.
Let it go. Let it go. Well, speaking of artists, as my oldest daughter was growing up, she drew horses everywhere. She drew horses on every piece of paper. She drew horses on napkins. She drew horses in her notebooks. She made little booklets of horses that were just pictures of horses, and then she would staple them together. I have all these wonderful horses. And it reminded me of the story. I said, I have the girl who drew horses. And so one day I was inspired to take the boy who drew cats and to adapt it as the girl who drew horses.
Cool.
So let me read that updated one to you.
Can't wait.
A long, long time ago, in a village on the western plains that lie beneath the mountains in the Americas, there lived a tribe of Indians who farmed the land. There were many children in the tribe, and they all learned to work to help to grow the food to feed the whole tribe. The tribe had a herd of wild ponies that they used to ride over the plains to the edge of the mountains. Now in this tribe there was a little girl who did not join the other girls in their duties. She was small and dark, very beautiful, but very wild, and did not seem to be built for working in the fields. She was also very clever and considered to be the smartest of all the children. One thing she was noted for throughout the village, she loved to draw horses. Hour upon hour she would spend drawing horses in the sands, on the walls of the teepees, carved in bark, or anywhere that she could find a surface to work. Over the years, her name at birth had been forgotten, and everyone called her the girl who drew horses. Now it came to be that hard times set upon the tribe. Rain was scarce and the crops died. The tribe leaders left the village and traveled to the top of the mountains. They passed through other villages on the plains in the shadow of the mountains and saw that these villages were now abandoned. They traveled to the edge of the mountains where they met the mountain tribes, who were living well, fishing and trapping stream animals. Finally, they climbed to the top of the mountain where they looked down across the great divide to the other side, and there they saw green valleys. The leaders knew then that the tribe needed to move to the new place. They were sad, but they were hopeful that their migration to a new land would be a good thing for them. All were happy, but for one family, the family of the girl who drew horses. Remember, she was small, beautiful, wild, and clever, but she was not strong. They feared that she would not make the journey without harm. As they traveled to the edge of the mountain, she rode atop her favorite pony. When they camped that night as guests in the mountain tribe, the girl's grandmother had a dream. She dreamed that they left the girl who drew horses with the mountain tribe, and that she became a famous and beloved member of the tribe. And in the morning she told the girl's parents about her dream, and together the family went to see the Indian chief. The chief pondered the dream. He looked at the girl who drew horses. She was beautiful, but she had always been wild, and she had never been strong. The tribe had loved her because she was one of their own, but the chief, too, realized that she would not be able to complete the journey across the mountain. He listened to the grandmother's telling of her dream, and he decided that it would be best to leave her with the mountain tribe. As the girl's family gathered around her to say goodbye, her grandmother took her aside and told her, "Now, my youngest daughter of my youngest daughter, you must stay here with the mountain tribe. You were not made to till the fields, and you cannot make this journey. But the mountain tribe can show you to draw their maps and tie their traps." The grandmother swallowed hard. She was sad. She was not sure what to say next, so she continued, "If you work hard, they may even love and respect you. You may never make a good farmer, but you may become a useful member of the mountain tribe." And then she leaned down to the little girl, who was now quite sad, and she whispered, "Let me give you one last piece of advice. Avoid open places at night. Stay within." The girl who drew horses waved goodbye to her family and her tribe. The mountain tribe took her in, and she joined the women and girls to tie the traps for harvesting the forest animals. She grew bored and began to draw horses. She drew them on the flaps for the traps. She drew them in the mud by the river. Everywhere she went, she drew horses. The mountain tribe realized she could not help to tie and set the traps, but she could draw. So the tribe members who drew maps of the best fishing and trapping spots took her aside to teach her about drawing maps of the sky and the stars and the rivers and the mountains. Each time they taught her and left her with bark and charcoal to draw these important maps, she would begin to draw horses again. Finally, the chief of the mountain tribe took her aside and said, "We took you into our tribe when we were asked. You are good at drawing, and you see things that most men do not. However, you cannot stay with us. You have another destiny, but it is not drawing maps or setting traps for us." With that, he brought out the pony her family had left behind as a gift to the tribe. He placed her on the pony and he said, "My daughter, you must leave our tribe and go away. You must find your destiny." And then for some reason he leaned down and whispered, "Let me give you one last piece of advice. Avoid open places at night. Stay within." The girl who drew horses was sad to leave the mountain tribe, and she began to wonder what she would do. And then she remembered one of the abandoned villages at the edge of the mountain. She pointed her pony downhill and traveled there. Now, as she traveled to the abandoned village, she began to wonder why it was empty. She did not know, but this had been a prosperous village until a mountain lion had attacked it. Several of the tribesmen had ridden after the lion to capture her, but they had never returned. The villagers packed their things and left, knowing that they would not be safe living there. They had dispersed into the mountain that looked down on their old homes. When she reached the village, it was almost dark. Old teepees were flapping in the wind. Without thinking, she pulled out her charcoal and her colored clays. She began to paint horses on all of the teepees. They were big horses, stronger than her pony. Soon she had painted a herd of strong horses jumping and running across the teepees of the abandoned village. She opened her bag of dried fish and beaver, and as she ate, she looked upon her work. She had never drawn such big horses before. The thoughts and questions about why she did that made her sleepy, and she was just about to lie down on the open ground when she remembered the words, "Avoid open places at night. Stay within." There were many teepees, and she found a large one. She took her pony within it with her, and she drew her bags together to make a warm bed. Then she lay down and fell asleep. Very late in the night, she was awakened by terrible noises. She heard loud hoofs and the growl of a lion. The noises became louder, and the lion roared a most terrible and deafening sound that filled the night. It was so awful that she was afraid to look outside her teepee. She huddled inside and lay very still with her arms over her head. Silence finally came, but she did not move until the first ray of sunlight shone through the wall of the teepee. She cautiously opened the flap and looked out. The first thing that she saw was that there was a trail of blood leading to the center of the village. She followed it and saw, lying there, dead, a very large mountain lion. But who could have killed it? And she looked around her and saw that the horses that she had painted had blood on their hooves. She realized that the horses that she had drawn had defeated the lion. She also realized why her grandmother and the mountain tribe chief had told her, "Avoid open places at night. Stay within." The villagers who had dispersed to the mountains also rose that day, and they looked down to find that the lion who had driven them from their homes was dead. They came back into the village and bowed before the girl who drew horses and thanked her for returning their homes to them. She became a beloved and revered member of the tribe and was famous among all the Indian tribes in the mountains and the plains after that. Some of the horses that she drew can still be seen on the walls of caves and are shown to visitors who come to see the area.
Wow. What a mother. You wrote a customized story just for your child. Who does that?
Well, you know, I've actually read since then that that's a great thing to do with your children. As you're reading them stories, take a story and put them in it, and it makes them feel special, and they help to continue the story with you. So if I can say that to anybody out there who's reading fairy tales to their kids, try doing that.
Did life imitate art?
Well, you know what? She became an artist, is an artist, and has actually sold a couple of her paintings of horses.
Oh.
And they are beautiful.
Wow. So did this story...
Well, here's my message to her. Yeah. You know, it's, she was a little like me in that she didn't have many friends, and she had her little... Mine was books, and hers was drawing. And it was to let her know, you will be beloved and revered. You will be fine.
Wow.
And so, yes, it's a hard life for an artist. She's starting out, but as I mentioned, she's sold a couple of the horse paintings. Yeah. The horse ones are fabulous.
Yeah.
And she still loves painting horses.
Cool. Wow. So, is she listening to the show?
She doesn't usually listen, but I get her to come and sit with me, and we listen to the archive shows on the radio program.
Yeah. Okay.
And I like to do that a lot with the kids. It's a way of me getting them together and sitting down, and I get to relive it.
So the story has another chapter when mother and daughter sit together as adults.
Yes.
And listen to your retelling of the story.
And reading it through to her to the end and encouraging her one more time. Follow your dream. Follow your dream. You have the talent. Follow your dream. And I just have to say, I couldn't live with that out that radio tab on the Houston Storytellers Guild.
Yeah.
I put it on and just pick out a story while I'm washing dishes, cleaning up. It's just, sometimes I might wipe a tear, sometimes I might laugh. It's great. Sometimes I listen to some of them two or three times.
What would you like our listeners to take away from this story?
There's two parts. Uh-huh. One is, read to your children and put them in the story. Make them the hero of that story. They'll love it. And it's very encouraging to them. And the other one is exactly the meaning of the story, is take your talent and be true to it. You mm-hmm. do have something to offer society.
I love it. I love it. Reminded me of a girl I grew up with who drew horses. I hadn't thought of it that way. She even went through a phase where she thought she was a horse, and she would walk and talk like a horse. She's now a veterinarian.
Well, see, she followed her dream.
I never put those two together until now. She definitely followed her dream, and I'm sure she's a good one. Well, thank you, Mary. I promised to bring Hank back in to join us now, and so he's here sitting beside me. And we wanted to ask him to use a little bit of his professorial skills and also his experience of working with this show for years and listening to literally at least hundreds of stories, if not thousands, and reflect a bit on what we've done tonight. We've called these stories folk tales. We've called them fairy tales. We don't really know what we're supposed to call them, though. What do you call them?
Well, actually, first of all, I was afraid you were going to say you were dating Mr. Ed, so I'm really, really glad that I was a veterinarian. I have to tell you, and this is absolutely not even close to an exaggeration, I'm amazed by the show tonight, and I've been leaving you notes along the show telling you that you need to hear this, because this shows a different side of both of you, an unbelievable side. The range that you've demonstrated is pretty unfathomable, to tell you the truth. But, you know, personal stories and traditional stories, as I call them, have a lot of similarities. They both have conflict and protagonists and plot and the like. But they are different. For example, in the food chain, the chronological food chain, the myth is first. Mm-hmm. The myth helps to explain the inexplicable. It's not unlike the kind of healing stories that you tell, Warren, because when you have a moment of despair, of this incredible trajectory, you want to know how to come out of it. You look for an answer. Mm-hmm. Well, now we have some answers. But the Greeks had, well, check out the goddess of Eos, because maybe she'll explain why you feel love. And things like that. But a myth really does explain the inexplicable. And these are hard to talk about, so I'm trying to be very clear. But the next one is a fairy tale. Now, the fairy tales are the ones that are scary stories because they're problem-solving stories. Mm-hmm. And it's the familiarity in a fairy tale that makes it scary. So, for example, Hansel and Gretel. If I asked you, have you ever seen trees? Of course. You ever see a house? Yes. Mean old ladies? Yes. There you go. That's Hansel and Gretel. And at the end of the story,
Some parents want to know why it's so gruesome. Why is it we have to shove the witch in the oven? Well, the reason is because we don't want our five-year-old to ask, Mommy, Daddy, what happened to the witch? And we say, we don't know. Maybe she's under your bed. Good night. No, we have to slam the door on that woman and make sure she's gone, gone, way gone, because the child has to know that bad people like that are gone forever. You know, a fantasy is when you start in one world and you go to another and then return to the previous one, like Wizard of Oz or Alice through the Looking Glass, the Tolkien tales. A folk tale is to keep a legend or custom alive. Paul Bunyan, Pecos Bill, Johnny Appleseed, and then you have legends which have an element of truth, like Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone and Jesse James. We call those legends. And then fables are short folk tales which characterize animals as personifying the human experience with a very quick parable. You know, slow and steady wins the race. But the beautiful thing really is that in a folk tale, because that's really what you're telling tonight, most of them, folk tales are wonderful because you can alter them and still keep the integrity of the story. So, in any event, but you guys are just, these are just fabulous, fabulous tales.
Myths, fairy tales, fantasies, folk tales, legends, and fables.
And rivals, right.
Wow.
Yeah. And they're all a little bit different, and all of them are extraordinarily similar to our personal stories. There's not a whole lot of difference.
Thank you, Hank.
Sure.
Well, Mary and Hank, we're just about out of time. Mary, you've shared stories that have reached way back into the ancient past. And all the way around the world. These stories have touched on some incredibly important perennial themes, protecting yourself from a world that isn't always safe and friendly, fighting off those who would exploit you and use you, learning how to transition from adulthood, from childhood to adulthood, finding your passion in life, whether that's a farmer or a priest or artist. Mary and Hank, you've reminded us that stories are thousands of years old, but they can still speak to us today. Well, some stories are thousands of years old, but they still speak. And you've reminded us we can translate and retell those stories for our present age. And we can even translate and retell them for our children. Mary, it's been a delight having you on the show.
Oh, this was wonderful, Warren.
Thanks.
It's got to go down as one of my favorite shows.
With me too. I'm glad we got back together. It's been about a year or two.
It's been about a year.
Yeah. Brian and Jason are next with To Tell the World, another class act on KPFT. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. Until next week, Mary, Nicole, Rocher Lynn, Alondra, Lisa, Greg, Hank, and I remind you, it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Alejandro Chaul and Chris McCann at the Jung Center for an evening of tea and meditation. This engaging lecture, meditation, and tea tasting takes place on April 20th from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. The practice of drinking tea can be deeply contemplative and a complement to a meditative practice, along with learning and experiencing the different varieties and benefits of tea. Participants will learn a simple take-home technique for a meditation that can become an everyday practice. Chris McCann has participated in over 1,000 tea tastings in the past 5 years. Alejandro Chaul, a student of Tibetan Buddhism for nearly 30 years, has studied with His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. Visit junghouston.org. KPFT Houston.
You are listening to KPFT Houston, which is supported in part by Houston Community College. HCC offers a wide variety of courses and degrees with affordable education for academic advancement, workforce training, career development, and lifelong learning. Summer enrollment at Houston Community College is currently open, with summer classes offering hands-on education.